All right, welcome everybody to our test one test preparation class for this junior and senior high class of American history with History at Our House. This is our first test of the year that we are preparing for, and so we are going to review your answers to the test preparation sheets. Procedurally speaking, let me ask that as we go through the questions on the sheets, that quite simply, once you have answered a question, that you give at least one more question that you skip after you've answered. So if you answer question one, please skip out on answering question two. Don't raise your hand. Don't offer your answer for that. And even skip two if you can, for the simple reason that we have a class here and everybody should be basically kind of working on this challenge, right? And so don't answer all the questions. Try to give other people a shot at answering them as well, okay? So, but other than that, go ahead and raise your hand away, and I will try to allow you an opportunity to answer more than one question, of course, and as many as you want, if possible, and to test out your answers. What we'll find is that at this level, it's often possible for the answer to be formulated a lot of different ways. So you're welcome, once you've heard another student give their version of the answer, you're welcome to give your version and see whether or not it would turn out as well, whether or not I'd be inclined to give you full marks if I were grading you, and that sort of thing. So it's kind of the old rule about the squeaky wheel gets the oil. It's in your case, it's the ambitious student gets the most attention and gets the most amount of feedback that's useful in getting, you know, and getting to the knowledge and getting to the awareness that we're looking for. So I encourage you to be as aggressive as possible in getting my feedback. This is your last chance to do it. Okay, so let's launch this thing here. Number one, what is the most commonly accepted view of history? What is missing from this approach? So, Sophie, get us started, please.
The most common way to describe history is history is the study of the past. This definition is missing that history is actually the study of the world we live in pertaining to important events in the past.
Okay, that's not bad, as the study of what's missing is the connection between past and present. Okay, in this approach, which connects the important events from the past to the world we live in. Okay, so I think you have to be careful of the formulation that you gave, in the sense that you said this, it's a study of the world we live in pertaining to the important history, the important events of the past. That's not quite, the formulation's missing a little bit there. It's missing that. I think we need a stronger statement of the connection. The sense of connection between past and present is what's missing. Okay, so I'm just trying to, an important thing when we're working with a difficult idea like this is to work on putting it in our own words and reformulating it and constantly batting it around. That way we'll take possession of it more clearly for ourselves. So that's what we're looking for here. That's what I want to see in the answer is, you had the first part really clearly. It's obviously the case that people think that history is about the past. What they're missing is the connection between past and present. To make it so that we think of history correctly as the study of the world that we live in. Okay, Alexander, how about your formulation?
The most commonly accepted view of history is that history is the study of the past. History is, in fact, the study of... Of how actions by important people in the past affect the world we live in.
Okay, so that's closer to this formulation. I would like to see, and I would encourage you to include, the more abstract statement. The more abstract statement would be the connection between past and present. Yes, I notice you're termed with your own handwriting. Okay, so see, that's what we're using there is the big words, the big abstractions. Past, which is all of it, every single action, everything, that every event, every person, right? That's the past, the sum of all that, that's the past. And the sum of everything around us right now, that's the present. So the connection between those two sums is what we're looking for. We get the whole thing. Okay, yes, it happens in certain ways. One thing that makes the connection is these actions, as you said, of important people. Right? Okay. So, anybody else want one more shot at this one? Everybody's in the ballpark. Everybody's working in the right, getting the right sort of answer. I'm just trying to encourage you to think about it a little bit more abstractly. And then with every single anchor fact, of course, our goal becomes to make that concrete in our thinking. To see, oh, here is an example of something from the past that connects to the present. Here's another thing from the past that connects to the present. We should be able to connect every single fact that we run into to the present. Juliet?
Can I say my answer for question one? Because I wasn't quite sure if I got
it right. Please. Yes, please.
The most commonly accepted view of history is that history is the study of the past. This approach makes people lose sight of history's connections to the present and makes them feel as if it does not matter.
That's perfect. That is the best answer so far. See, because you use that formulation of the idea that the past is disconnected from the present and therefore it doesn't matter. We need to reconnect. We need to integrate the two. Okay, excellent. That was a perfect answer, Juliet. All right, let's connect on a concrete level here, fact by fact. Number two, we should be able to run through these pretty blisteringly quickly and easily here. Timothy.
Who, what, where? Menes and Armor unifies Egypt. When? Circa 3000 BC. So what? This system, monarchy, is the norm until 1776 AD.
Okay. I would even go to the point of a little bit more abstraction in the sense, again, of you said 1776 AD. I would say that it's a little bit more useful to think of it in the following terms. This is the norm. Monarchy is the norm until the advent of America. See, that's a different kind of a statement, isn't it? If you say this is the norm until a certain date, well, now you're one step removed from the identification that there's a reason why we focus on that date. So you can jump right across to the fact that it's America without, you know, it is 1776 AD, but you're kind of one step removed in your statement. So I would say, and it's so crucial to say that, okay, because we don't live. Why is it crucial to say that? Well, because we don't live in 1776 AD. So a so what statement should probably not end with some datum in the past. It should end or involve something that is true today. Get the difference, right? So what always has to be a today question, not a past question. So what is the question that connects past and present. So I would change that to be, monarchy is the norm until America. Now we've got the today part. Okay, Bria, alternate?
No, I wanted to do three.
All right, everybody satisfied with two? Anybody want to test out their version of two? Otherwise, Bria, take it away on number three, please.
Okay. Roman Athens created the Republic and then the Democracy in circa 509 BC and circa 508 BC. So what? The Founding Fathers learned from these examples to build America.
Okay, nice. So we have America at the end, right? So these are, another way to put that, where these are the first two precedents of freedom. These are the first better governments until... And then we got America, this thing that persists to this day. Okay, so good. I would be careful of, I think you did okay on this, but I would be careful about the way that you say, what I would do is I would say, the Athenians, the people of Athens created a democracy, the people of Rome created a republic. I would make sure that they are divided. You could put a semicolon between them or something to make sure that you are clear which ones did what. And so you could write, if you want to do Rome first, because technically it happens first, that's all right, right? But you got to keep the order right, okay? It's a minor point, but it's worth being precise. Athens 508, Rome 509. So you could kind of flip them. You could say Rome 509, Athens 508. Maybe we really should, because that helps us to highlight the sequence as we believe it to have occurred. Okay, thank you, Bria. You're definitely right there as well. So, Erica, you want to do number four?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Who, what, where? Sorry, one second. Okay. Who, what, where? Jesus Christ is born in the Roman Empire. When? Circa 4 BC. So what? Christianity is the most important religion in history, and we still use a calendar based off this event.
Great. Perfect. All right, that one's starting to become reflexive. I like it. I see that it's flowing. Ben, different formulation or next fact?
Next fact.
Okay, hold on here. Let's always give a little bit of time for somebody to raise their hand pertaining to. I would like to try out my formulation on this current one, okay, before jumping ahead. All right, but since I don't see other hands shooting up, then Ben, go ahead with number five.
Okay. Who, what, where? Germanic barbarians caused the fall of the Roman Empire. When? 476 AD. So what? This caused the world to be primarily European rather than primarily Roman.
Okay. Good. And linguistically, how do we feel that difference, Ben?
Because we don't speak Latin.
We don't speak Latin, we're speaking English, or people in Brazil are speaking Portuguese, the people in Mexico are speaking Spanish. Oh, those are all European languages. That's a very kind of superficial reflection of that. A deeper reflection of that would be the types of governments that have proliferated throughout the world. A deeper reflection would be the type of art that has proliferated throughout the world. It's permeates the societies of the world. These European features of culture, including the separate countries, the little minor differences that lead people to group themselves into little tribal enclaves, the borders that we draw, they're drawn by European countries. There's not a country in the world that hasn't had its fate materially determined by a European empire. Amazing. Truly amazing. Okay, so any other formulations for number five before we go to number six? Bria, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the so what on that one.
Okay, the simple version is we don't live in a Roman world, we live in a European one. Okay? And the language we're speaking is how we can see that as quickly and simply as possible. Beyond that, we need to learn more history. Beyond that, we need to learn about government. We need to learn about culture and other things to appreciate the full extent of that statement. But we can start with language. That's our first indicator. Okay. Number six. Simple one. This one should be really quick. Timothy?
Who, what, where Christopher Columbus discovers America. When? 1492 AD. So what? There cannot be a United States of America without the discovery of America.
All right. Again, we're getting there. I'm feeling it. This is getting reflexive here. I feel like number four and number six are really flowing. The other ones are still good. I don't have a problem with what anybody's saying, but these ones are starting to become reflexive. I really like that. It's got to be automatic. And then we start to have an unquestionable foundation. We have these really powerful mooring posts that we can always activate anytime we need to make a connection to something and bring it to the present. So that's good. We live, it's so amazing. And nowadays, you know, there's a lot of controversies about Columbus Day. And we are going to have a nice big long weekend because of Columbus Day. In history at our house, we celebrate Columbus Day. Why? Because we want to celebrate the fact that history has led to the creation of the United States. And apart from the founding fathers, there's one man that bears more responsibility and therefore gets more credit for that happening than any other human being in history. Because there can't be a USA without the discovery of A. So, if people in Seattle don't want to celebrate that, they're making this new thing nowadays, and it's getting increasingly common to celebrate the pre-Columbian people in America, well, that seems like a mistake to me. Because those pre-Columbian people were not going to make the United States of America. They were extremely primitive, Neolithic barbarians. I don't want to live in a Neolithic barbarism, so-called. I want to live in this amazing, interconnected, America-centric world. I love it. It's the best time. I'm a historian, and I can say this with authority. This is the best time to be alive that's ever been. So, celebrating Columbus Day is a part of that. It's about embracing the fact that, yeah, there's a lot of things that have happened in history, and a lot of them are bad. But we are in this America-centric world. Thank you, Christopher Columbus, for being so brave as to go a month in one direction entirely on the confidence of your reasoning mind that eventually you would get around the sphere and you would get to a new place. And it turns out it wasn't the place you thought it was, but thank you for being so brave to do it anyway, because we got an America out of it. All right. So, enjoy your Columbus Day weekend. You really should if you want to celebrate the fact that America is here. Number 7. These other guys deserve their own, but we have another day for them. So, what's the day for them, Juliet?
Who, what, where? The Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in Pennsylvania. When? 1776 AD. So what? We live in an America-centric world because they made the greatest country in the world.
Okay. I wouldn't focus on Pennsylvania. That's too broad. I would say Philadelphia, because that's where it was. And so, you know, Pennsylvania is a big state. They didn't do it in so much in Pennsylvania as they did in Philadelphia, okay, which was the capital at first, right? So yeah, I would say Philadelphia. I'm not too keen on saying, I mean, it's okay that Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania, right? But Pennsylvania is too vague. Okay? So, yes, they're creating this great country, which, by no accident whatsoever, is going to rise up and become the most influential country in the world. That's why we live in an America-centric world. Piper, did you want to try your number 7, or did you want to go to number 8?
Oh, I was going to go to number 8.
All right. I think we can afford that. Go for it.
Who? Muslim terrorists. What? Flew into the World Trade Center. Where? New York. When? 9/11, 2001. So what? We live in a world of terror.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's say, luckily we don't live in a world of terror. That would mean that they beat us. But we do live in a war on terror, right? I mean, yes, there are some terrifying things in the world. And if you ever watch the news and you find out what these Islamic State people are doing in the Middle East, that is terrifying. No question about it. Okay, but we don't live in a world of terror. You woke up this morning and you did not have a day of terror. We are not studying history in a world of terror. There are these people out there that need to be defeated, no question about it. But don't say we live in a world of terror. We do live in the war on terror, which is an important chapter of history. Okay, so just watch that little specific thing there. Okay, put your hand down unless you have a follow-up there, Piper. So, let's move on now to part 3. Number 9, if the Roman Empire had fallen... I laughed when I reread this question, but anyway. If the Roman Empire were not fallen, what language would we probably be speaking today? Give two examples of expressions still in use from Latin that are used in the recording of historical events. It was kind of a gimme, wasn't it? So, Ben, go ahead.
Okay. If the Roman Empire had not fallen, we would probably be speaking Latin today. Two Latin expressions still used in the recording of historical events are circa, which means about, and anno domini, which means in the year of the Lord.
Right. Okay, there we go. Among all the others. So, at your age level, you might be able to use a vocabulary program called Vocabulary from Classical Roots. Has anybody heard of that from by a show of hands? Does anybody do Vocabulary from Classical Roots? So, if you haven't heard of it, you should look into it. Vocabulary from Classical Roots is a great vocabulary program. And what it does is it shows you how the words that we use are built and out of the Latin and Greek roots from which they come and how the meaning of the words derives from Greek words and Latin words. So it really gives us a very interesting insight into how our language was constructed. So it's called Vocabulary from Classical Roots. I highly recommend it. I used to teach vocabulary alongside of history, and I found it to be a really wonderful program. At a junior high level, you're certainly ready to do it. Okay, number 10. What kind of government did the different people of Europe create after the fall of Rome? Since when had this been normal for people around the world? Alexander.
After the fall of Rome, the people of Europe created many monarchies. This had been normal for people around the world since 3000 BC when Menes Narmer unified ancient Egypt.
Okay, good. Pretty straightforward. Let's keep going. All right, number 11. What extent of conflict had decisively shaped the cultures of France and England as we find them in 1492? What was the outcome of this conflict? So, Sophie, please.
The Hundred Years' War was extremely important in shaping France and England. The connections between France and England were broken at the end of the war, and all the land England had in France was lost.
Okay, yeah, that'll do it. The Hundred Years' War. I would give you full marks for that, basically. I don't want to criticize. I might encourage you to try to include the dates of it. Hundred Years' War from 1337 to 1453, maybe, would be nice. And maybe a little background. So there's a five-line. I try, but I don't always succeed, to give as much room as I would like, as I think the answer should receive. So kind of try to gauge your answer there. If you're hitting at least three lines, or 4 to 5 lines, that's probably the right indication. It sounded pretty good to me. Okay, anybody want to try a different formulation? Welcome to do it. Alexander?
The Hundred Years' War from 1337 to 1453 had decisively shaped the cultures of France and England. The outcome of this conflict between the French king and the English king, who was also the duke of a large territory in France, was that France and England became totally separated as worst enemies forever, and their cultures were permanently ingrained with hatred for each other over generations.
Ooh, that was slick. That was great. Nicely done. I like that. All right, so we got... did you get that part, Sophie? Was it Sophie or Erica? The part about the hatred. I think maybe that you missed that one. So as far as the outcome of the conflict is concerned, right, we need two things. We need the decisive split, the separation of the two cultures. But we also need the worst enemies forever concept in there, right? We need that the people had become just powerfully, as Alexander says, ingrained with a hatred for each other. So what they basically still to this day feel and do very much is they think of themselves, I'm English. And as a part of that, there's a kind of instantaneous and unquestioned belief and sense that that's better than being French. and that French people somehow, without necessarily being able to say what it is, are wrong and not as good. And the same thing goes for the French, right? To be French is to have a strong sense that you're independent of and different from Englishmen and better than them. And it's not as horrible as it once was. It's not necessarily, I mean, French people and English people now, you know, are not as likely to see each other and want to impale each other on a sword. But they still feel a pretty strong antagonism, even after a long time where, you know, they've basically been at peace and tended to be allies, as we will see. But it's still this thing that's deeply a part of how they feel about themselves. Timothy, go ahead.
In 1066 AD, a man named William the Conqueror became King of England. The problem, he was also the Duke of Normandy in France. This sparked a 400-year argument that ended in the Hundred Years' War. In the end, both France and England were scarred and became WEFs, worst enemies forever.
All right. I like it. So you tied it back to the, you kind of angered it in 1066. And, yeah, and you brought in Mr. Powell's goofy expression, worst enemies forever. Okay, fine. So, I like it. All right, let's go to number 12 here, unless you have a burning issue for number 11, Ben. Number 12, who were the different rulers of Hispania? This is a good question. From ancient times to 1492. What were two crucial outcomes for the culture of the region in the time of Columbus? All right, we're going to find that this question has got, you know, has a little research component in it, and you're going to need to have quite a bit, you know, it requires some extra thinking. You can't just find the answer. So, Ben, do you want to do that one?
Okay. The rulers of Hispania from ancient times to 1492 were the Visigoths. In circa 711 AD, Hispania was invaded by Muslims, setting off war that lasted until 1492. Two important outcomes of this war were Portugal becoming an independent country from Spain and the timing of Columbus's voyage to America.
Interesting. See, so now this is where we get into the subtleties of the different kinds of answers. And so you're pretty, that's a good answer. But it's not true to say that the Visigoths were, I said different rulers. And your initial statement says the Visigoths were the rulers from ancient times to 1492. Well, you missed out on something here, right? What is Hispania in the first place? No, he had the part about Muslim invaders in the second sentence, right? So that part you didn't miss out on, although it was a little bit implicit. You didn't say the different rulers of Hispania from ancient times were the Visigoths and the Muslims. That would have been a little bit clearer way of formulating it. But you also forgot some stuff here. So the first thing is, who were the rulers of Hispania in ancient times? Where do we even get the name from? It's the name of a province in the Roman Empire. So I'm trying to make that kind of a hint, right? Hispania is the name of the province in the Roman Empire. So the first it was the Romans, then it was the Visigoths. So it'd be nice to see the Romans in there. I would have them down for about a half a point on this question. The Visigoths, and then the Muslims. And then I would say the Spanish and the Portuguese along the way. The Christians who became the Spanish and the Portuguese. So this is kind of the extended overflight of the story of the Reconquista, or, you know, all the way back to ancient times. And then your crucial outcomes were interesting. Your first crucial outcome was that Spain is separate from Portugal. I think that's a decent answer, except the way that I would put it would be this, that two independent Christian countries were formed during this period, Spain and Portugal. Not so much kind of Portugal became independent from Spain, but two independent countries were formed in the process of the Reconquista. Okay. And so that would be more connected to your answer of the first question. Notice the connection between the two questions. If your first answer had culminated in the Spanish and the Portuguese, then it would have been easier for you to kind of formulate it that way when you're answering the second question. Two crucial outcomes. We have two independent Christian nations. Okay, and also, well, there was, the second one was the timing of the voyage of Columbus. Okay, I would go along with that, okay, but that's not so much an outcome for the culture of the region. So we're missing something there. We need to be kind of careful and precise about what we're saying. What was an outcome for the culture of the region relating to the succession of rulers? You get the question? The people of the time had a certain culture. What was it in 1492? How did it relate to their past, to the succession of rulers through this territory? The fact that they were separate, Spanish and Portuguese, that's one. But there's another one, and to some extent, it's much more significant overall in history. What is it? What were they like? Alexander.
So should I just say my answer?
Well, can you answer that quickly?
Two outcomes were that they were devoutly Christian and they didn't like Islam or any other religions.
Yeah, right. So you could say they were militantly Christian. So yeah, devoutly is one thing. Devotion is a feature. It doesn't necessarily involve violence. Right? So you can be devoutly nonviolent. But these were devoutly violent people. Right? They were people whose identity, just like the French and the English, they became who they were, was connected to the violence that had shaped them in tribal times and then in later times. And who these people of Spain and Portugal were was really deeply connected to their long history of religious conflict. So they absolutely defined themselves as Christians, and also very strongly with this sentiment of anti-Islamic, there was a word the Greeks would call it, animus. It was this part of their soul that they were violently Christian. More so than others. You know, if you don't have to grow up in a war, you're not going to be, as you guys hear, nobody in this classroom, right, is some kind of violent crusader who's thinking today, how can I get up and impale somebody, right? It's just not part of our thought process, because we don't live in a war, right? We don't live, and know that you're joking, Bria. So right? We live in a peaceful society with religious toleration and religious freedom, and these are wonderful attributes of American society. So you don't have this problem, right? But the Spanish and the Portuguese did. They were not inclined to toleration for good reason. They'd been invaded by people who definitely intended to impose a different religious belief. So it was a big deal to them. Their world was a world of religious conflict, religious war. Alrighty. So, yeah, that is, you know, this question here. Some of the questions you're going to get are slightly mechanical or more concrete, right? You find the answer in the notes, you put the answer on the page. It's a pretty basic exercise. But life isn't like that. So there's, you know, it requires thinking. Right? So you need to be able to sort through the information of history yourself, and at some point, as you move out into the world as an independent adult, you need to be able to interrogate information and come up with your own conclusions about it. So some of these questions are designed to help you gradually develop that skill set. It's not something you have to do by this afternoon. It's something that you have to learn gradually over time. And so take these questions on and struggle a little bit with these ones as much as you can, because these are the growth questions. All right, these ones here, the factual ones, and you know, the ones that you can find the answer, that's not really much of a growth exercise. But it can be important nonetheless. But these ones, number 12 here, is more of a growth question. All right? So, let's do number 13. So, what country was at the center of Christian Europe? Who were two leaders hoping to be in charge of it? And how had their conflict... Oh, that should be there. Oh, Mr. Powell, tisk, tisk, tisk. That should be a possessive there. I'm going to have to fix that. Conflict shaped the culture of Europe of 1492. So once again, the second part's a little bit sophisticated. So, Sophie, go ahead.
The Holy Roman Empire was the disputed center of Europe. The Pope needed protection, and the German king needed the Pope's authority to keep the German duke under control. Once the king promised to protect the Pope, he got the title of Holy Roman Emperor. Both the Pope and the German king thought they had the most power. This conflict continued for so long that Italy and Germany failed to become organized countries. Neither the Pope nor the king gained the most power in the end.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I mean, that carries you through, basically. It's a pretty detailed narrative. So it might be in your interest to think about how you can summarize it. And so, you know, the basic outcome was that nobody from among the German kings and the popes had managed to stamp their authority absolutely upon this arrangement. There was a conflict which had resulted in the center of Europe being a very unstable, troubled part of the world, rather than being the core, rather than being a solid center. It really was a shifting mess. And as a result, we're not going to be talking about Germany making colonies in America. We're not going to be talking about Italy making colonies in America. Those parts of the world have too much trouble of their own. And in particular, it's all about whether or not there could be a Christian country with an emperor and a pope. And is that a formula that works? And so that's the cultural problem there. Alexander, what's your formulation?
The Holy Roman Empire was at the center of Christian Europe. The Pope wanted to be in charge because he was the leader of Christianity, but the Holy Roman Emperor thought likewise about himself and didn't want to take orders from the Pope. In the end, the Holy Roman Empire was disunited, unlike its neighboring kingdoms, and the Pope became much less important to most of Europe.
I like that very much. That's a good summary kind of formulation about it, right? The basic conflict. Pope wants to be on top. Holy Roman Emperor wants to be on top. Their inability to resolve this had made it so that Germany was not united, and therefore there really wasn't a center, a hard core to the center of Europe. Juliet?
The country of Christian Europe was the Holy Roman Empire. The two leaders who wanted to be in charge of it were the kings of Germany and the popes, who were the head of the Catholic Church. And their conflict shaped the culture of Europe because Germany and Italy had been fighting for so long that they were not organized kingdoms like the rest of Europe, which meant neither pope nor king could claim a preeminent role in Europe.
Ooh, that was nice. This is a great place to end for today. And I want everybody to pay attention to this, because this is a great answer in a number of different ways. So one of the most important ways, for those of you who are still a little bit new to Mr. Powell's type of questions, and in particular to, you know, test taking and so on, one of the arts of test taking is paying as close attention as is necessary and is proper to the nature of the question. Because if you're going to get the answer right, you better be answering the question. What Juliet did here was very smart. And Alexander's done this. You might have heard his answers kind of formulated this way as well. And so kind of students have done this in the past and gotten this advice from me, are using this method, and it's a very good method. I want you to notice how, Juliet, I want you to reread your answer. And I want everybody to pay attention to, as Juliet is reading her answer, how her answer is structured to mirror the question. Okay? What she's doing is she's taking the question and turning it into the answer. It's a really nice approach. Okay? So, listen to Juliet's answer and read the question while you're listening to her. Go ahead, Juliet.
The country center of Christian Europe was the Holy Roman Empire. The two leaders who wanted to be in charge of it were the kings of Germany and the popes, who were head of the Catholic Church. And their conflict shaped the culture of Europe because Germany and Italy had been fighting for so long that they were not organized kingdoms like the rest of Europe, which meant neither pope nor king could claim a preeminent role in Europe.
Okay. Fantastic. Really, really good answer. Right? So she used the structure of the question to shape the answer. It just flows so nicely. That can be a real help to you. Okay? Good. All right. So I'm impressed. You guys did well. You're looking like you're in a pretty strong position with regard to the upcoming tests. So basically what's going to happen here is the recording of today's class will be posted to the class webpage along with the test. And then you will have, pretty much it'll be up to your parents to implement the test as they see fit. And then early next week, a grading key will be posted. And your parents will, again, at their discretion, grade your test based on the grading key or some preferred method of implementing the key. So Keen, the exception there is you. You'll be emailing a scan of your test to me, and I'll be grading your test. But anyway, I think that you guys are in pretty good shape. So let's see if there are any last questions with regard to the test. So, Keen, go ahead.
Yeah, so what's the final due date on my test?
Oh, very good question. So I need to have it in my inbox before the next class, which would be Wednesday. So you have a long time. Okay. Alexander, what about you? Why can't I unmute you? Unmute yourself, Alexander. Okay, what's going on? How come you can't unmute yourself? I feel like I'm experiencing... Let me just stop sharing for a second and see whether or not I can regain control of this feature. Alexander? Oh, why did it have to end this way? can anybody hear me? Yes, same, yep, same. What does that mean, same? Maybe.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Alexander.
Okay. Nobody could hear you for about 15 seconds while you were
answering. Yeah, all right. So now we're back. Alexander, go ahead.
So, first of all, whatever happened to bonus questions of remembering that...
All right, thank you for the reminder. I might add bonus questions on later tests. Thank you, I forgot about that. Okay, what else?
Second of all, you've kept saying in previous years that I never wrote my answers down. Uh-huh. I have never not written my answers down. I always wrote my answers down.
Oh, okay.
Even while I was doing the recordings. And even if I wrote down some strange things. But anyway, my third question is, where is that nice course schedule with the green dates that tell you when you have holidays on the new website?
All righty, let's go to that, why don't we? So just since it may help more than just Alexander, let's go to the home page and bring up the calendar. Share my desktop. Here is the History at Our House webpage. If you go to 2014-15 news, which is 2014-15 is our current school year, And I'll click on that, and I'm sure with my high speed it will quickly take us there. Or not. Waiting, waiting, waiting. Ta-da! The very first thing that shows up, academic calendar. Columbus Day break with a PDF version. It's no longer preliminary, so I probably need to tweak that link name. But it's right there on the web page, and it is also there available as a printable PDF. Okay. So, as it says, oh, it says October 2nd, test 1. Now, that turned out not to be true, didn't it? So, huh, yeah, so there was a little bit of an offset there. But I will try to maintain the test dates coming up, you know, in a pretty relatively stable arrangement. So, it might be something to watch whether or not I'm able to keep the exact dates. But, anyway, thank you for bringing it up. I feel like I'm having a problem with WebEx. Let's hope that it's not debilitating. I can see that my computer is struggling a bit with WebEx. Okay. Bria, what about you?
Question number one. Are all the little blue numbers the ones that we have days off?
Yeah. It's you'll be able to read it. There's a little grading. There's a little key to everything on there. You'll see, you know, a Christmas break. You'll see Thanksgiving. You'll see obvious days off. It'll make sense. All right. Thank you, guys. Have a great long weekend. You don't turn in the test, Bria. You don't turn in the test. Only, in this case, only Keen is going to turn this in. It's up to your parents. Bye for now.